Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Vanderbilt.
And I'm Sam Astor.
And today we are doing a deep dive into the Wall Street Journal for Friday, December 19th, 2025.
It's great to be here. We have a massive stack of sources today, and they really paint a picture of just how complex and, I mean, frankly, how contradictory things are in the global economy and in politics right now.
Absolutely. Our mission is to give you a really comprehensive, exhaustive look at everything in these materials. We're going to unpack, well, a very uncertain economic picture, this incredible intersection of huge capital demands and really speculative tech.
Things like fusion energy, yeah.
Exactly. And then there's the fallout from trade wars and some intense behind-the-scenes political fights happening both here in Washington and around the globe.
And what really stands out to me right from the top is how many of the core numbers, you know, the data points we're supposed to rely on are just proving to be unreliable.
You mean like the inflation numbers?
The inflation numbers, campaign metrics, you name it. It's like investors and policymakers are being forced to operate blind. So let's just jump right into the financial world, because the big headlines seem positive, but the data underneath, well, it's in crisis.
Okay, so let's start there. The Consumer Price Index report, the CPI, the markets, I mean, they just loved it.
Oh, they went wild for it.
The headline inflation number eased to 2.7% year over year in November. That's down from 3% back in September. And the core measure, you know, the one that strips out food and energy, that dropped to 2.6%.
So if you just read the headline, you'd think the Fed's long war against inflation is over. Victory declared.
And the stock market certainly thought so.
Absolutely. It was a huge rally. The S&P 500 jumped 0.8%. The NASDAQ, which is heavy on tech, shut up 1.4%. Even the Dow was up a little. It was a classic risk-on day.
All based on this idea that the Fed now has the green light to keep cutting rates.
But, and this is a really big but, the economists in our sources were basically unanimous in saying, hold on, do not read too much into this report.
Why not? What's the problem?
The problem is huge, unprecedented gaps in the data collection. And it's all because of that government shutdown we had earlier this year.
Right. So we have this great looking number, but the way they calculated it is fundamentally broken.
That's a perfect way to put it. It's like trying to get a weather forecast when half your satellites are offline.
Yeah.
The shutdown went all the way to November 12th.
Okay.
And that made it impossible for the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the BLS, to do their in-field data collection for a really critical period. They just couldn't send people out to check prices in stores in October and early November.
So they had to improvise.
They had to use workarounds, technical imputations.
Yeah.
And the analysis suggests these workarounds very likely biased the November inflation figure downward.
Meaning the number is artificially low?
It probably is, yes.
Yeah.
We have a number that looks cool, but it's likely not the real temperature.
So let's get into the weeds here. What were the specific mechanical problems that warped this data?
There were two big ones that sort of compounded each other. The first has to do with seasonal adjustments, especially around Black Friday.
The holiday shopping season.
Exactly. By the time the BLS workers finally got back out there, retailers were already in the middle of these huge post-Thanksgiving sales. Deep discounts everywhere.
And the BLS has a formula to account for that, right? To filter out normal holiday sales?
They do, but, and this is the key, that formula is designed for a normal November, where they have weeks of data from before all the big sales kick in. They didn't have that this time.
So they applied a normal formula to abnormal data, and that basically exaggerated the price drops.
Precisely. It makes it look like prices fell more than they really did. But the second problem is actually much bigger, and it has to do with housing.
Which is the single biggest part of the CPI.
It's the biggest weight in the whole index, yeah. Specifically, what they call rent of shelter. And the way they measure it is complicated. It's not a snapshot. They use a formula that averages rent changes over the past few months.
And because of the shutdown, they had no data for October.
Correct. No October data. So the BLS formula was forced to just assume a zero increase in housing prices for that month.
They just plugged in a zero.
They plugged in a zero.
Yeah.
And that flat reading then got fed into the November calculation, which artificially pushed down the estimated rent levels for November too.
And that's a huge red flag for economists, right? Because housing inflation is supposed to be sticky. It doesn't just fall off a cliff.
It drops off very gradually, usually only in a recession. So this sudden sharp drop in a persistent service component like shelter, it just looked wrong. It screamed data problem.
So you have an artificial drop in shelter costs, the heaviest part of the index, making the whole inflation rate look way too good, way too fast.
And that's why you get quotes like the one from Alan Detmeister at UBS. He basically said we should, and I'm quoting here, largely just put this one to the side. He said the vast, vast majority of this is just noise and should be ignored.
Which tells you everything. It's great for market psychology, but it's totally useless for the Fed when they're trying to make actual policy decisions.
That's the consensus. And you can see that skepticism in the bond market.
Right, because despite the stock rally, Treasury yields didn't really move that much.
They stayed pretty steady. And that's the bond market saying, nope, we don't trust this one weird data point enough to bet that the Fed is going to suddenly speed up its rate cuts.
They're waiting for the December and January numbers.
They're waiting for clean data. And this whole mess just compounds what's been just a terrible year for the BLS.
A really difficult year, yeah.
I mean, it's been one setback after another. They were already understaffed, dealing with tight budgets, and now this. Plus, you have to remember, they were dragged into a political fight earlier this year when the president fired the commissioner.
Alleging the jobs numbers were rigged with no evidence.
Right. So you put it all together, the political interference, the budget cuts, and now these critical data gaps from the shutdown, and it highlights a really significant risk to the whole system.
If you can't trust the government's data,
if you can't produce reliable, non-political data, how do you steer a $27 trillion economy? You can't. All your decisions become much, much riskier.
So while Washington is struggling to even get a clear picture at home, other central banks are on the move. And that has global consequences, especially what's happening in Japan.
What the Bank of Japan, the BOJ, just did. You can only describe it as seismic, at least for global capital flows.
They raised their policy rate target to 0.75%.
Which for Japan is the highest it's been in three decades, 30 years. This is a country that has been fighting deflation for generations. Now, all of a sudden, they're dealing with sticky inflation. It's a profound shift.
And this connects directly to something called the carry trade, which has huge implications for anyone holding U.S. assets.
It does. And if you, listening right now, hold U.S. stocks or high-yield bonds or even crypto, this seemingly obscure move in Tokyo matters to your portfolio.
So how does it work?
Well, for years, Japan had interest rates near zero. That made the yen incredibly cheap to borrow. So big investors, you know, hedge funds and the like, they'd borrow billions of yen for almost nothing.
And then what?
They'd immediately sell that yen for dollars and use the dollars to buy assets that paid a much higher return, like U.S. treasuries or tech stocks. It was like a free money machine, as long as the yen stayed weak.
But now the BOJ is raising rates, so that trade suddenly gets a lot less attractive.
And a lot riskier. Two things happen. First, it costs more to borrow the yen, so your profit margin shrinks. But second, and this is the big one, a higher rate strengthens the yen.
Which is a problem when you have to pay the loan back.
It's a huge problem. If the yen gets stronger, you need more dollars to buy back the yen to repay your loan. That can wipe out your entire profit and even cause massive losses.
So the risk is that all these investors rush to unwind the trade at the same time.
That's the nightmare scenario. They'd be forced to sell off those U.S. assets, stocks, bonds, whatever, en masse, just to get the dollars to cover their yen positions.
And that could crash markets far outside of Japan.
It's a huge destabilizing risk, which is why this seemingly small rate hike from the BOJ sent a real warning shot across global finance. And just for context elsewhere, the Bank of England cut its rate to 3.75%, and the ECB in Europe held steady.
Okay, let's hopple back to our own central bank, the Fed, because they made a move that was pretty technical, but has some really big implications. People are calling it quiet QE.
Right. Most people focused on the Fed chair's latest interest rate cut.
Yeah.
That was the sixth one since September of last year. But buried in this really dry implementation note was the big news.
Which was?
They announced a plan to buy about $40 billion in short-term treasury bills over the next month, with more purchases likely to follow.
Wait, buying treasuries? Isn't that the definition of quantitative easing? QE, which they're supposed to do in a crisis, not now.
It is essentially QE, yes. They're expanding their balance sheet. But they're framing it as a technical adjustment to maintain what they call the ample reserves regime.
Okay, you have to break that down for us. What is the ample reserves regime?
So think of bank reserves as the commercial bank savings account at the Fed. After the 2008 crisis, new regulations forced banks to hold a much bigger safety buffer of these reserves. The Fed also started paying them interest on those reserves, encouraging them to hold even more.
And that system, with banks holding way more reserves than they legally have to, that's the ample reserves regime.
That's it. And the problem starts when the Fed tries to do the opposite of QE, which is quantitative tightening, or QT. when it sells bonds to shrink its balance sheet.
Because that drains reserves from the system.
Exactly. And if reserves fall below the level that the banks want for their safety buffer, the whole system can seize up. This happened back in the fall of 2019 in the repo market, and interest rates shot through the roof. The Fed is seeing signs of that same tightness now.
So to stop that from happening again, the Fed is being forced to buy treasuries to inject reserves back into the system.
They are. All to satisfy the commercial bank's demand for high reserves, a demand created by post-2008 regulations.
Which raises a really fundamental question, right? Who's actually driving the bus here?
That's the critical implication. It seems like the bank's demand for reserves is now dictating the Fed's balance sheet policy, not the other way around. The central bank is sort of letting its creditors steer the ship.
And the suspicion is that the Fed's current massive balance sheet might be the new normal.
The new minimum, yeah.
Yeah.
Around 20% of the entire U.S. economy. Yeah. We may never go back to pre-2008 levels. It's structural QE, just disguised as a technical fix, all while they're supposedly still fighting inflation.
It's a picture of a central bank just navigating a world of flawed data and structural problems.
It's uncertainty on top of uncertainty.
And that kind of uncertainty, it's perfect breeding ground for big speculative bets. Which brings us right to our next section, this incredible intersection of technology, AI, and massive, massive capital.
The transition is perfect because that sheer scale of capital we were just talking about, it's being mobilized for this high-stakes tech arms race. And the first example is just wild. The merger between Trump Media and Technology Group, TMTG, and a fusion company called TAE Technologies.
This is a $6 billion deal. It's the first family's biggest move yet into mainstream finance, into the broader economy. And the logic, the strategic hook, seems to be fusion energy as the answer to AI's power problem.
That's the pitch. And I mean, on paper, it makes a certain kind of sense. The AI industry is just consuming a staggering amount of electricity. Data centers, training models. Our current grid can't handle that kind of growth.
So fusion, if it works, offers this clean, limitless power source. It's the theoretical solution to AI's biggest bottleneck.
And the Trump administration has already been pushing programs to boost fusion R&D to meet exactly this demand.
But fusion is the ultimate spec tech, isn't it? It's the elusive holy grail that's always been 10 years away for the last, what, 50 years? So how close is TAE, this company, to actually delivering?
Well, TAE has been around for a while, since 1998. They've raised over $1 billion privately. And their claim is that recent advances mean the biggest hurdle now isn't the technology, it's the capital.
So this merger gives them the money they need.
It gives them a public platform, access to equity. And their goal is incredibly ambitious. They're talking about first power in 2031, starting construction on a utility-scale power plant next year.
Okay, I have to push back on that. I mean, we all heard about the big breakthrough at Lawrence Livermore back in 2022, where they finally achieved net gain.
Right, more energy out of the reaction than they put into the target. A huge scientific milestone.
But net gain is not the same as net power, right? Isn't there this enormous multi-billion dollar engineering gap between a lab demonstration and a power plant that can run 247 and actually light up a city?
You've hit on the exact issue. That gap is the chasm that this $6 billion valuation is trying to leap across, and is why the scientific community is so skeptical.
What do they say?
Adam Stein from the Breakthrough Institute, he pointed out that he was surprised that TAE hasn't published any peer-reviewed scientific evidence of a breakthrough that would justify launching a utility-scale project this big.
So they're basically saying, trust us, the science is ready, just give us billions of dollars to start building.
That is precisely the risk that you as an investor are buying into. It's a massive valuation based on a promise, not on published, verifiable proof that the core technology is commercially viable.
And we can't ignore the politics here. I mean, this is the first family's biggest venture into the mainstream economy since returning to the White House. It immediately raises conflict of interest concerns.
It does. The administration is already pushing hard for government subsidies for fusion R&D, and now the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., is going to sit on the board of this new combined company.
That creates a very tricky environment for any kind of regulatory oversight, especially with government R&D money on the line.
It really does.
Yeah.
It's part of this broader pattern of the family's business empire getting intertwined with these high-risk, high-reward sectors.
Well, moving from speculative energy to the AI sector itself, the capital needed there is on a whole other level. I mean, OpenAI is reportedly seeking up to $100 billion in new funding.
$100 billion, with a potential valuation of $830 billion. It just shows you the insane cost of staying at the front of the AI race.
And the sources say OpenAI is expected to burn through over $200 billion by 2030, just on training costs and hardware.
It's incredible cash burn. So they're aggressively courting sovereign wealth funds. They just signed a big licensing deal and got a $1 billion investment from Disney. They are literally buying their survival because in this game, scale is everything.
And they need that money because the competition from Meta and Alphabet has gotten so intense.
It is an all-out war. OpenAI CEO Sam Altman actually declared a co-erd for the company earlier this year because he saw competitors closing the gap so fast.
And Meta is launching a direct counterattack.
They are. Two big new models. The first is called Mango, and it's all about generating high-quality images and video. The second is Avocado, their next big language model, and its main focus is improving coding abilities.
Why the focus on images and video?
Because it's sticky. Altman himself said image generation is what really grabs consumers. It keeps them engaged, coming back to the platform. Alphabet saw a massive user spike when they launched their Nano Banana image tool, and that put immediate pressure on OpenAI to respond.
So the race is about raw computing power, but also about locking in those key consumer features.
Exactly. Who can create the most compelling, engaging experience?
Well, the outcome of that race will shape our future, but there is another battle going on that will determine who pays for it all. And that's this massive tax fight between the IRS and Meta.
A $16 billion fight.
Yeah.
And this is so much more than just a big number. The IRS is using a brand new, completely untested legal argument here. And if it works, it could completely change how the government taxes multinational corporations.
And the basic issue is the classic one, right? How you tax things like patents and software that companies license to their subsidiaries in low-tax countries like Ireland.
That's the core of it. This all goes back to a licensing deal Meta made with its Irish subsidiary way back in 2010. And traditionally, the IRS would analyze that deal based on what was known at that moment in time.
So they'd ask, what was a fair price for that intellectual property back in 2010?
Right, which often favors the company because nobody in 2010 could have predicted the phenomenal growth Meta was about to have. But now the IRS is trying a new backward-looking approach.
They're using something called periodic adjustment.
This is the legal bombshell. There's a clause from a 1986 tax law that says profits from these transfers must be commensurate with income. The IRS is now arguing that this gives them the power to look at what happened after the deal was signed.
So they can look at Meta's massive success in the 2010s and say, hey, that initial price in 2010 was way too low, so more of those later profits should have been taxed here in the US?
That's the argument. They are fundamentally changing the rules of the game after the fact. It completely upends decades of corporate tax planning.
This creates huge uncertainty for every multinational company out there.
It's a massive systemic risk. And this is the so what for you listening. Some economists think that if the IRS wins this, it could cost corporations up to $1 trillion in back taxes globally. It's a slow-moving legal battle, but it could redefine international business.
And the government's willingness to even try this shows how determined they are to get a bigger piece of that corporate profit pie.
Which you need when the costs of everything else, like AI development and national security, are just soaring.
That sets us up perfectly for our next section, because the Glo Commerce that funds all this is itself being completely rewired by policy, specifically by U.S. tariffs.
This is all about unintended consequences. When President Trump put heavy tariffs on Chinese imports coming to the U.S., it worked, in a way. Chinese exports to us contracted by almost 20%.
But that production didn't just disappear, it had to go somewhere else.
And it was redirected. It created what our sources are calling a tsunami of cheap stuff that just washed right over Europe instead.
China is showing this incredible logistical agility.
They really are. The European Union has now blown past the US to become the biggest market for China's low-value e-commerce packages. We're talking about $100 billion a year.
And the growth in some of these EU countries is just staggering.
It is. Shipments have quadrupled to places like Hungary and Denmark. They're up 50% or more in Germany, France, the UK. And to make this happen, they had to build a whole new logistics infrastructure, a sort of new Silk Road for e-commerce.
And a big part of that is what you call shadow logistics.
Yeah, this part is fascinating. It's the rise of these family warehouses. often run by Chinese immigrants in Europe. Sometimes it's a stay-at-home parent who gets paid by a Chinese merchant to store inventory in a spare room or a shed in their backyard.
Right. There was the story of Zhu Er in the UK, a mom in her 40s who built a shed in her garden to store fast fashion clothes.
And she's making real money, 3,000 to 5,000 pounds a month, just packaging and shipping these orders. It cuts down delivery times for European customers dramatically.
And they can do it so cheaply.
The prices are unbeatable. For small packages, they charge as little as 70 cents. A big commercial warehouse just can't compete with that. Now, on the other hand, you have people like Cao Ying in Germany, who runs a professional warehouse, and even she says Europe is becoming a dumping ground for what she called shoddy, messy junk.
And all of this is supported by new air cargo routes.
Upstart airlines like My Freighter are running 200 flights a month, just hauling e-commerce packages for companies like Temu. It's a logistical marvel, but it's triggered a huge backlash in Europe.
And that backlash is about labor, safety, culture, all of it.
The Shein controversy in Paris is the perfect example. They opened their first permanent store there, and it sparked huge protests from local retailers.
But then it escalated into a legal crisis.
It did. France moved to suspend Shein's online platform after listings were found for, just horrific items like child sex dolls and brass knuckles. Shein blamed an outside merchant and pulled the listings, but the damage was done.
And beyond that, there are just basic consumer safety issues.
Serious ones. European consumer groups tested over 100 items from Shein and Temu and found that 70% of them didn't comply with EU safety regulations.
And some of these were really dangerous.
Incredibly dangerous. There was a necklace from Shein that had 8,500 times the legal limit of cadmium, which is a highly toxic metal. This isn't just about price competition anymore. It's about undermining fundamental safety standards.
And that has finally forced a policy response, which brings us to this thing called the de minimis rule.
The de minimis rule is the key loophole that allowed all of this to happen. It's an old customs rule that lets small, low-value shipments, usually under 150 euros, enter the EU without paying duties or undergoing standard safety checks.
Because it was too expensive to process them all individually.
Exactly. But now, facing a threat to its own retail industry, which employs 30 million people, the EU is finally fighting back.
What are they doing?
First, a stopgap measure. They're going to impose a small 3-euro fee on these packages starting next July. But the big change is coming in 2028.
What happens then?
They're going to close the loophole completely. The UK is planning to do the same in 2029. It's the end of the line for unchecked, duty-free entry for these goods.
So while Europe is getting flooded with cheap stuff, American consumers are dealing with the opposite problem, paying more for high-end European goods because of tariffs.
It's the other side of the tariff coin, and you can see it very clearly in the wine industry. Much of the next vintage of European wine is going to carry a new 15% tariff.
So distributors are warning that prices for French, German, Italian wines could jump by 15 to 30% next year.
That's a huge jump, and you're already seeing the behavioral response. People are panic buying.
Right. The anecdote about Kelly Bartlett, who works in finance, just stocking up on German Rieslings now because she knows they're about to get a lot more expensive.
It changes your household budget. You either drink less or you pay more. And it's not just wine. We saw Birkenstock, the shoe company, weighing in on this too.
What did they say?
They're a great example of a global brand having to absorb these costs. They warned that the U.S. tariffs will hurt their profit margins in fiscal 2026. They're expecting their margins to compress from about 32% down to around 30%.
So the cost of these trade wars gets paid either by the shareholders in lower profits or by us, the consumers, in higher prices.
One way or another, someone pays.
Okay, from the complexities of global trade, let's bring it all back home to domestic policy, where a truly massive shift is happening with cannabis.
This is a huge deal. A presidential executive order directing the Attorney General to expedite the rescheduling of cannabis. Mm. This is going to fundamentally restructure the entire legal marijuana industry in the U.S.
So just to be clear for everyone, where is marijuana classified right now and where is it going?
Currently, it's a Schedule 1 drug. That puts it in the same category as heroin. Schedule 1 means the federal government says it has a high potential for abuse and, crucially, no accepted medical use.
And it's moving to Schedule 3.
Right. Schedule 3 is for prescription drugs, things like ketamine or testosterone. So the move is an official acknowledgement from the government that cannabis does have accepted medical applications.
What are the immediate practical impacts of this, especially for the industry, which has been legal in many states but has really struggled to make a profit?
The impact is immediate, and it's twofold. First, and this is huge, it eliminates the heavy tax burden from Section 280E of the tax code.
The rule that stopped them from taking normal business deductions.
Exactly. They were being taxed on their gross income, not their net profit. Getting rid of 280E will make a lot of these companies profitable overnight.
And the second impact.
It opens the door for real, large-scale medical research. It was incredibly difficult to study a Schedule I drug. Moving it to Schedule III smooths that path, which is a stated goal of the administration.
Now, advocates have wanted this for years, but it's happening despite some pretty significant public health criticism, especially around the comparison people make between marijuana and alcohol.
Right, that's where the debate gets really important. The political argument is often, well, we treat alcohol this way, why not marijuana? But an opinion piece in our sources argues that's a very dangerous comparison.
What's the data they're citing?
They're pointing to studies on mental health, particularly the long-term risk of developing schizophrenia. Mm. For people who experience a marijuana-induced psychosis, that risk is estimated at 46%. For alcohol-induced psychosis, it's around 5%.
That's a massive difference.
It's a huge disparity, and they argue you just can't ignore that when you're setting national policy. The data on misuse rates also tells a similar story.
What does that show?
Federal data shows that about 32% of past year marijuana users meet the criteria for use disorder. For alcohol, that number is 12%. So the argument isn't necessarily against personal liberty. It's against the move toward mass commercialization of a product with a 32% misuse rate and these significant mental health links.
That's a really important piece of context for this policy shift. Now let's pivot from policy to personalities, because there was some incredible drama in Washington this week with the chief of staff, Susie Wiles.
I mean, this was a genuine shock to the system in D.C. A sitting chief of staff just does not give candid interviews to Vanity Fair where they openly criticize the vice president and the attorney general. She broke all the norms.
But the president's reaction was what was so surprising, right? It tells you everything about her actual power.
It tells you she is completely indispensable. The old conventional wisdom would say she'd be fired instantly. Instead, President Trump just laughed it off, called her fantastic. He even agreed with her assessment that he has an alcoholic's personality.
And the people she criticized, they just fell in line.
They did. The vice president agreed he could be a conspiracy theorist. Attorney General Bondi, who Wiles said had whiffed on some issues, called her a dear friend. The usual internal leaks and calls for her head were completely absent.
Which shows a whole new level of discipline in this administration.
It's a huge strategic shift. Their main focus was not giving the media a scalp. By praising her, the president validated her candor and cemented her authority as the one person who can manage his staff without fear. It's a completely different dynamic from the first term.
Okay, on the other side of the aisle, we saw the DNC chairman, Ken Martin, reverse course on a key promise about the 2024 election.
Yeah, he decided not to publicly release a detailed internal review of all the mistakes the party made in the last presidential election. He called releasing it a distraction before the midterms.
Even though he had promised to release it publicly.
He had. He's claiming they're already applying the lessons learned, but it's a classic case of an institution choosing to suppress its own self-criticism.
So what were the key lessons that actually did leak out from this review?
There were several big ones. First, on the economy, they found that the campaign's messaging just wasn't credible to a lot of swing voters. The official stats they were citing didn't match people's lived experience with high prices.
A failure of communication and empathy.
Right. Second, they found that candidates were too defensive on issues like public safety and immigration. They weren't proactive. Third, a big one, was poor campaign organizing quality.
What does that mean?
It means they were measuring the wrong thing. They were measuring how many doors they knocked or calls they made instead of how many meaningful conversations they actually had. They needed to focus on quality over sheer volume.
And the last big takeaway was about the youth vote.
They admitted they took the youth vote for granted. They allowed the president to make significant gains with younger voters, especially through right-wing digital media, that the DNC just wasn't countering effectively.
So it's a party still struggling to adapt its messaging and its technology.
It seems so. Now let's turn to this conflict between the Department of Justice and the FBI over the Mar-a-Lago search in 2022. The Senate Judiciary Committee released emails that show a Well, an alarming internal fight between the two agencies.
And this information is so crucial because it suggests that the whole raid on a former president's home might not have even been necessary.
That's the implication.
Yeah.
The emails show FBI officials were alarmed. They were forcefully pushing back against the DOJ's strategy, suggesting the DOJ was focused on a maximalist aggressive approach right from the start.
And the FBI even had concerns about the strength of the evidence, the probable cause.
They did. They pointed out that the intelligence was from a single source, it hadn't been corroborated, and it might be dated. They noted very little has been developed related to who might be culpable, but the DOJ just kept churning out draft after draft after draft of the warrant application for 6 weeks.
One FBI official called that 6-week focus on a warrant counterproductive. What were the alternatives the FBI was proposing?
They laid out three very clear, less intrusive options. Option one, just contact the Trump attorney again, who had already been cooperative. Option two, contact the former president himself, since he'd said publicly he would cooperate. Option three, ask the National Archives to handle it through a normal administrative process.
And the DOJ refused to consider any of them.
They refused all three, which really suggests a singular focus on a raid and a criminal case. There's an email from an FBI agent who was worried because the lead DOJ attorney, Jay Bratt, already had an antagonistic relationship with the Trump team.
And the other DOJ lawyer, Donald Toscash.
That's the most damning quote. Toscash said on a call that he frankly doesn't give a damn about the optics. The agent concluded that if the DOJ made first contact, it would not go well.
It raises this incredible, troubling question. Could one of the most politically explosive events in recent history have been avoided with a simple phone call?
And was that option deliberately taken off the table? That's what the emails suggest.
A powerful revelation. Let's broaden our scope now and look at the international stage, at shifting alliances and ongoing conflicts.
Let's start with U.S. policy in Asia, specifically toward Taiwan. President Trump recently announced one of the largest ever arms sales to the island, and this was an explicit move to calm down allies who were worried he was getting too soft on China.
This is an $11.1 billion package. HIMARS rocket systems, howitzers. What's a specific military goal here?
The goal is what's called deterrence by denial.
Okay.
You give Taiwan the weapons it needs to make any Chinese invasion so costly and so difficult that they won't even try it. It's about slowing down an attack, not necessarily waiting for the U.S. cavalry to arrive.
And this is happening even as the president continues to talk about his warm friendship with China's leader, Xi Jinping.
Right. And that's the tension. But this arms sale exists in a much bigger context, with the U.S. trying to maintain military superiority in Asia. And the clock is ticking. A House Committee on China report warned that the late 2020s are an imminent danger zone. Because Xi Jinping has publicly stated he wants the Chinese military to have the capability to forcibly take Taiwan by 2027. The report called for unambiguous, clear U.S. opposition to prevent a miscalculation.
And that whole situation is amplified by this deepening China-Russia alliance.
They're no limits partnership. They are absolutely working together to challenge U.S. influence around the world. Their synergy is political, it's military, it's industrial.
Xi and Putin have met over 40 times.
And militarily, they've dramatically increased their joint exercises in Asia, in Europe, even in the Arctic. We saw a real-world example on December 9th when they flew joint bombers near Japan and South Korea, forcing the U.S. and Japan to scramble their own fighter jets.
And China is also a critical lifeline for Russia's war effort in Ukraine.
Absolutely critical. They're not sending tanks, but they are sending crucial dual-use goods. Things like computer chips, sensors, fiber optic cables, commercial items that have direct military applications.
And that's allowing Russia to ramp up its own weapons production.
It's helped them triple their production of certain ballistic missiles. And it's a two-way street. Russia is likely helping China with advanced submarine propulsion technology in return. This is a real partnership aimed at restructuring global power.
Shifting to the Middle East, the president's peace plan for Gaza seems to be completely stuck.
It's hit a wall. Phase one was a success. It ended the war and got the hostages out. But it left Gaza divided, with Israel controlling half and Hamas controlling the other half.
And phase two requires Hamas to disarm.
And that's the problem. Hamas refuses to disarm. They won't give up control. And that creates a domino effect that stalls the whole plan.
The U.S. is pushing for an international stabilization force, right?
They are. They're hoping for about 10,000 troops. But no country wants to be the one to go in and fight Hamas to disarm them. And Arab states won't deploy troops only in the Israeli-controlled zones because they don't want to look like they're propping up an occupation.
So for now, everyone is just stuck in this divided status quo.
Entrenched and, for the leaders, seemingly comfortable with it, while over 2 million displaced people in Gaza continue to suffer.
Finally, let's look at Venezuela, where the Trump administration is escalating its pressure campaign with a partial blockade of oil exports.
The pressure's been ramping up for a while, starting with military strikes on suspected drug boats, and now this. But the problem is, the administration is giving multiple conflicting reasons for why they're doing it.
Right, we're hearing three different goals. Stop drugs and gangs, pressure Maduro out of office, and secure access to Venezuela's oil reserves.
And that ambiguity is creating a lot of confusion, even inside the government. Aides aren't sure what the actual end game is. Is it regime change? Is it a negotiation?
It risks looking like another open-ended foreign intervention, something the president has long railed against.
Exactly. And some analysts warn that this kind of economic starvation can actually backfire. It can make citizens even more dependent on the autocratic regime for survival, which reduces the chance of a popular revolt. The policy just lacks a single, clear, strategic objective. A world of conflicting goals and unclear data. Okay, let's wrap up with some fascinating corporate and cultural tidbits that kind of reflect these strange times.
Let's start with a cultural phenomenon from the world of travel that is just causing chaos. It's being called the Jetway Jesus Scourge.
I think we've all seen this, even if we didn't know the name. It's able-bodied people requesting wheelchair assistance to get a kind of VIP experience.
Right. They get to skip the long security lines. They get priority boarding, which means they get first dibs on the overhead bin space.
And then the punchline is, once the plane lands, they have a miraculous recovery. They just stand up, grab their bags, and walk off.
And it's being fueled by social media, people bragging about it as the ultimate travel hack. Mm-hmm. But it's causing huge operational problems for the airlines.
It's not just a minor annoyance.
It's a crisis. Some flights are getting 50 wheelchair requests for a plane that only seats 130 people. It causes massive delays, and it's especially bad for passengers with genuine disabilities who end up having to wait an hour or more for an available attendant. And the flight crews get frustrated because they often don't get paid overtime for these delays.
Right. Southwest Airlines in particular has had problems because their open seating policy creates an extra incentive to game the system. And they just announced they're finally going to implement assigned seating to try and combat this chaos.
Okay, switching gears to Wall Street. Wells Fargo is having a record year in a business they used to ignore, investment banking.
This is a major turnaround for them. They've jumped 7 spots to rank 7th in the U.S. M&A league tables. That's their highest rank ever since 1980. They advised on huge deals like Netflix's bid for Warner Bros.
And this is all credited to their CEO, Charlie Scharf.
It is. He made a very deliberate push to hire top talent and shift the bank's focus away from its old mantra of kitchen tables, you know, retail banking, to what he calls league tables, meaning high-end investment banking. It's a total repositioning of the company's identity.
Meanwhile, the boardroom battle at Ben & Jerry's just keeps going. The independent board members are now accusing the new owner, Magnum Ice Cream, of trying to kick them out.
This is a long-running fight over the company's social mission, especially its stance on the Israel-Gaza conflict. The board is refusing to oust its chair, Anuradha Mittal.
And Magnum is demanding that they undergo mandatory training.
And they have to affirm their compliance with Magnum's Code of Business Integrity by December 23rd. Magnum says this isn't an allegiance pledge, just standard procedure, but they've also imposed new 9-year term limits on the board members, which will force the chair out immediately, and 2 others by the end of next year.
It's a clear move to exert corporate control over a very activist subsidiary.
No question.
And finally, let's wrap up with this political and cultural collision in D.C. The Kennedy Center might be getting a new name.
The board, which has many members appointed by the president, voted to rename the venue the Trump Kennedy Center. And it is, as you can imagine, highly controversial.
Democrats and other members are saying the board doesn't even have the legal authority to do it without an act of Congress.
Right. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer called it proof that the president cares more about his ego than about issues like high prices.
And this isn't happening in a vacuum. It's part of a bigger push by Trump allies to rename things after him.
Not at all. There are movements to rename the U.S. Institute of Peace and even Washington Dulles Airport. And you have to remember, the president had previously installed himself as the chairman of the Kennedy Center board, which was an unprecedented move for a sitting president. It's all about putting a personal stamp on these national landmarks.
Well, we have covered an incredible amount of ground today. We've seen global commerce being rewired, geopolitics being defined by these shifting alliances, and domestic politics driven by strong personalities and these hidden data fights.
It really is a dizzying snapshot. And if you think back to where we started this conversation, a theme really emerges. And it's the increasing difficulty of just finding high-quality, non-political information anywhere.
We started with that inflation report, which was basically broken by a government shutdown.
Then we talked about a $6 billion merger for a fusion company, where the scientific experts are saying, where's the published proof? And then we saw the DNC literally suppressing its own internal review, calling the truth a distraction.
The very systems we rely on for economic data, for investment, for political accountability, they're either giving us bad signals or they're hiding the truth. So what does that mean for you, the listener?
That's the challenge to think about. When the inflation data is flawed, when the claims behind a $1 billion merger are scientifically unverified, when a political party actively withholds its own mistakes, you can't just trust the signal anymore. You have to look at the underlying mechanics.
It requires a whole new level of skepticism.
It does. In an age where objective data is so often distorted or just deliberately obscured, how do any of us really determine what is just actionable noise and what is a reliable signal that you can actually build your decisions on? It's a question you have to ask about everything you read and hear now.
A challenging and very necessary task. Thank you for guiding us through all of this today.
It was my pleasure.